In the House, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, the members who represent Willmar named that corridor in statute the Little Crow Corridor out of respect for the Native American tribe that had been in that region. And so I actually suggested that perhaps we could call it something different. I proposed the W Corridor, W for West, Wayzata and Willmar, and they said, no, it really exists in statute. And so, Senator Olson, that's why we're now calling it this. We may have a nickname when, you know, later. But.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, this is not a like a commuter rail following some existing rail tracks. It is following Highway 12.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, no, it is the rail tracks, and that's what we showed, and that Mary Vogel from the university actually went through this presentation that we used to use this particular rail for passenger rail until the 70s, and then they stopped using it for passenger rail, and now they're using it for freight, but there's only 9 times a day that go on it. It's the one that goes from downtown Minneapolis by Penn and actually goes by East McGinty down out that way, ends at the Wayzata Depot, those tracks, and then goes straight out to Willmar. And so it's the same corridor I've been talking about, but it is the existing rail tracks, okay. And there would have to be very little done to upgrade this because already the freight trains are going 60 miles an hour. We do have some stations. There would need to be some minor upgrades. my legislative assistant is showing the route. Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. It's good to have somebody that tech savvy in the room. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, did you want to see any other pictures?
No, Mr. Chairman, it drops below 394. I can't visualize not driving in those neighborhoods where that's going, but I can visualize a couple places where it crosses.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I was just curious, and I don't know if Senator Bonhoff knows this, but why would this be revised to the statewide transportation plan and not the statewide rail plan?
Senator Sieben, I was considering it the statewide rail plan, but maybe Ms. Berezovsky could address that.
It'll take a bigger amendment because this is the part of stitch.
Senator Bonhoff, that's probably a larger amendment than just changing one word in this bill, because this is the statute that deals with the statewide transportation plan. What we'd have to do is kind of have this probably get a delete all amendment so that we put it in the correct section of law that deals with the statewide rail plan.
So, Mr. Chairman, I was really just looking for doing this study, and so I was given the jacketed versions, and that's how the House members drafted it, so perhaps they've made an error in their drafting. Mr. Chairman, would it make sense to be part of the statewide plan, or do you think that?
I do believe that it should be part of the rail plan that's being put together now.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Could I ask counsel how she'd recommend we handle it?
Well, I tell you what, Senator Bonhoff, why don't we just set this aside for a second, and then we'll talk about it a little
Thank
bit
you.
In the meantime. Okay. So we'll just put Senate File 933 on the table, and we'll try to figure this out in the meantime. So 933 is on the table. Next up is Senate File 492, Senator Scogin and your mini trucks.
We're going to call him.
Okay, I guess they ran up to get Senator Scogin. Senator Dahl, let's go ahead with Senate File 1124. Senator Dahl and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an agency bill regarding commercial driver's licenses. Basically, this legislation would prohibit the use of administrative penalties, stays of adjudication, and expungement process, insofar as they permit moving violations and certain other offenses from reaching or remaining on the record of a commercial motor vehicle driver. And the reason that we're bringing this forward is, well, twofold. One is that we're out of compliance with federal motor vehicle safety standards, and we want to bring that into compliance. There's a risk, or a pretty serious risk, that we'll begin losing federal funding due to our noncompliance. It could reach up to, at least in current rates, of close to $46 million a year. And the other reason is, you know, more basic, that it's just a safety issue, that those driving commercial motor vehicles, we want to make sure that we have a complete record of their driving history. And I have Ms. McCormick here to answer any questions or added to what I may have missed.
Okay, Senator Dahl, let's just see if this is if this would be a correct statement. This does not do anything to those jurisdictions that are currently using this program, other than if somebody has a CDL, they have to report regardless.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
I get it. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
You know, we've heard all these talk about admin fines and stuff, and how do you police that? You know, if a community is issuing admin fines and they continue to do that, you know, maybe not realizing somebody has a commercial license or it slips through, how do we, I guess the bigger question is what's happening with the admin license or fines? But
well, there's some people that feel that administrative fines are unconstitutional. Others feel that it doesn't work very well because of issues like masking, and others think that it's the best thing since sliced bread. And since this committee can't get a bill to support either side out of it, I guess that's where it lays right now. So as long as you know, all the counties and jurisdictions that are using administrative fines are aware that we're passing this law, hopefully becomes law, then it shouldn't be an issue. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, this again, this is only for CDL holders. So, you know, maybe there's some issues in a locality where they don't know that. But I mean, if they're checking, they should be able to determine if they carry that type of driver's license. And it's only for those that hold a CDL.
Senator Dahl, did Judiciary request to see this bill? Probably not.
At this point.
No. Okay. So then Senator Dahl moves it. I'm sorry, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dahl, if I remember right, doesn't this, don't we have to have something like this to be in conformance with federal motor vehicle carrier regulations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, that is correct, yes. We've already been cited twice now, I guess, in audits, and the next time they will start to impose the penalties. First year would be 5%, which is, should be about $23 million. Second year would be 10%, so we've written every subsequent year. So,
Mr. Chair and members, I think we can hardly afford not to pass this kind of a bill.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Ms. Spierzowski brings up a good point. Maybe Ms. McCormick can answer this, but we were cited under federal statutes, which were?
I'm wondering if we have state statutes or programs that the federal government found to be constantly asking.
Yeah. Okay, here's the question, Ms. McCormick. Do we have statutes in Minnesota law that we were cited for under this masking issue? Or we were just cited because we have allowed the administrative penalties to go forward?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick from Driver and Vehicle Services. We were cited in our audits because of the fact that our law did not specifically say what this bill says, which is that we would not allow
and expungements or stays of adjudication or continuances for dismissal for commercial driver's licenses. And obviously, they told us that what we had to do is make sure that we had this law changed so that it's clear that we are doing everything we can to prohibit masking of any violations for commercial drivers. And that was in our 2004 audit as well as in our 2007 audit. And they come every 3 years to do an audit. And they audit not only our driving records, they audit our statutes and how we implement the statutes as part of that audit that they do.
Okay. Any further questions for Senator Dahl?
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Ms. McCormick, and Senator Dahl and I talked about this before, but we have the problem of where this addresses the persons that hold CDLs at present and that we cannot mask anything that happens to them in going forward. But are we not in compliance if there have been violations that have been masked before a person gets a CDL? And at the point when they've gotten a commercial driver's license, they've had mask violations in the past.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, when the initial legislation at the federal level, the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act, came out, there was direction from Federal Motor Carrier to the department that any driver could be a potential CDL driver, and so we couldn't allow any masking. And then they reinterpreted their federal regulations, and they said that the only time the state would be held as being noncompliant is if it was a current commercial driver in which their violations were expunged. And that goes along with the fact that the employers of commercial drivers are also held accountable if they let a commercial driver drive with a disqualifying offense on their record. And so I think there was further discussions, and that's the clear direction we've been given, that we're only talking about commercial drivers and drivers that have that license at the time of the conviction or the disqualifying of offense.
Thank you. All right. On Senator Dahl's motion that Senate File 1124 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Dahl. Ms. McCormick, thank you again. I did see Senator Scogin floating around in here. If he's here, well, here's... He wasn't floating, he was sprinting. Senator Scogin, Senate File 492, mini trucks. And I believe you have an amendment. Do you have an amendment?
I do have it. It'll need all to put it kind of in the shape I want, and then a verbal amendment as well. We kind of missed one part. But
okay, well...
Move the A1.
Okay, on the delete all amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Scogin, where's your oral amendment?
My oral amendment would be to remove on page 2.4 through 2.8, to remove subdivision 3.
Do we have it?
Oh. Mr. Chairman, we haven't got it yet, so.
Okay, it'll just take a second here. Okay.
It's the subdivision on hours of operation.
Okay, what we want to do is we can't just remove subdivision 3 because it's existing law and it's part of the section. So
we have to move some numbers to
it? We have to reinstate the strictum language and delete the new language.
All right. Senator Scogin, I'm gonna make your motion for you so it fits, because if we do what you just said, we would take out a whole section of law, and I don't believe that would be appropriate right now. We'll just take out the underlined words and then replace the stricken language.
Sorry about that.
That's not a problem.
Right, Mr. Chair. You don't want golf carts out at night?
Well, I've seen some people driving carts at night, but not well. Members, Senator Scogin is moving to reinstate the stricken language on line 2.4 and delete the new language on 2.5. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Senator Scogin, on your bill now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today you have before you a mini truck piece of legislation. For those of you who are not familiar, we do have line 1.5 the description of a mini truck. They are bigger than the Type 2 ATVs. We don't want them on our trails. We don't really want them in our ditches because they are bigger and heavier. And the reason I bring this is because out in the farming country, we are starting to see farmers who have purchased these mini trucks and are using them in agricultural operations, mostly where I live, on irrigation systems and on fence lines. They typically will have a bed, about a 4-by-6-foot bed, that's about 10, the whole truck is about 10 feet long, about 5 feet high. They are exactly what they're called. They're a mini truck. Farmers would like to go from point A to point B. A lot of times the irrigators have 12 or 13 or 14 different systems that they have to check on and haul some pipe and some tools. And they have been going up on the roads and getting stopped and ticketed and in some cases asked to tow them out of the area. And so they have come to me with a request to find a way for them to be used in a reasonable manner. We thought about trying to get them licensed, and they really don't line up with some of the safety requirements that we have. So I think this legislation is a good compromise. I've had some conversations with Public Safety and State Patrol and others who deal in public safety with motorized vehicles. And so you see the legislation before you as a description. And then we get into Subdivision 1 where we would allow governing units, counties, cities, townships to authorize a permit to allow them to travel on certain roadways. This would get them out of the ditches and off the trails and would allow them to move around, as I said, point A to point B, doing their work. And it would be on I kind of look at it out where I live on a county-by-county basis, let the counties issue the permit. And everybody who owns one in that county would be allowed to come up on the roads. They'd have to stay off the bigger and faster highways, the four-lane stuff, and anything that's over 55 miles an hour, of course, they wouldn't be allowed on. Some of this language, of course, is also applicable to all-terrain vehicles and motorized golf carts as well. So we tried to find a place for them in that family of the smaller and less used equipment, I guess. Mini trucks are you're gonna have to have a valid driver's license to get up on the road with them. They do have headlamps and tail lights. They've got turn signals. They have fully enclosed cabs, windshield wipers, seat belts. They are just a small truck, and there certainly is a safety consideration. That's why we don't want them up on the big roads, but I would like to be able to let those who want to use them out in rural Minnesota find a place to drive them.
Yeah, members, this is the exact same thing that we do for several other vehicles. Excuse me. And you can see those. Those are all designated there in that first subdivision under Section 2. You know, motorized golf carts, four-wheel all-terrain vehicles, the mini truck issue has had a lot of discussion here over the last few weeks, and I think that Senator Scogin's done a pretty doggone good job of getting this thing worked out so that some people in the agriculture community can still use these and yet be law-abiding. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, how is it different from the, not the ATV, but the four-wheel or six-wheel utility vehicle that is usually produced by the ATV manufacturers that, you know, has a cargo box? They may or may not be fully enclosed in terms of a cab.
That's
is that the difference?
That's
is this a new Is this a new breed, and is it manufactured by the ATV people, or are the automobile companies making them, or is it something totally different?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, this is not manufactured in the United States yet. These are all brought to the United States. Most of them come out of Japan or Korea, and they're bigger than the Gators, the Type 2 ATVs.
Or but Rangers.
They're players. The Rangers. They're bigger than that. In fact, they're typically over 1,500 pounds dry weight. They'll be 1,000 to 1,500 pounds dry weight, and then you can, of course, put up to 1,000 or 1,200 pounds in the bed. So they can become quite heavy if they're loaded fully. And another feature that you pointed out, they have enclosed cabs, all the lights and mirrors and windshield wipers, seat belts, that kind of stuff. Five-speed transmission typically. Get great gas mileage. That's why my farmers want to use them. Rather than jumping in that half-ton four-wheel drive pickup, if they know that they're just checking irrigation, they can throw the pipes and the wrenches and stuff in there and maybe their electrical equipment, and they can head down the highway and not use much gas.
And Mr. Chairman, what is their speed that they generally go?
When they come to the United States, they go about 35, and when they get to the farmer's house, they go about 55. I believe when they are shipped, there's a pin in the transmission that doesn't allow you to use the top two gears, and I haven't been able to confirm this, but when they go by me, they're not going 35, and I think somebody has figured out how to tap that pin out of there. So,
Senator Dipple.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that the definition we provide says propelled by electric power or internal combustion. How many of them are made with electric motors?
I haven't been able to find a mini truck that's electric yet that has come to the United States.
No. Senator Olson just said those are the slow ones. There is a myth about electric cars. They perform as well and to the same standards as any other car. So.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin. It sounds like when you say that they have headlights, taillights, wipers, seat belts, that there's a standard that they're being manufactured to. Is there a standard, perhaps outside the U.S., that they're being manufactured to?
Well, Senator Carlson, Mr. Chair, I believe there is a standard to whatever standards the Korean or Japanese standards are for. They in their country, they're sold as all-terrain vehicles, off-road vehicles. And I don't know what that standard is, but it certainly isn't the standard that we build ours at.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When appropriate, I would move Senate file number 492 as amended be recommended to pass and go where it needs to go.
It needs to go to the Senate floor. That would be part of the motion. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scogin, I just had a question on the insurance on like 2.28. If you're a farmer and you had one of these, could you insure it under your farm policy, or would you? I'm not sure about that Minnesota automotive risk plan.
I may need to have counsel's help on this. I think, Senator Olson, Mr. Chair, that you could request that, but your farm policy wouldn't necessarily have to allow that. And if that's the case, you can go and get insurance through this, I believe.
It's state mandated.
Okay. So if they have nothing at all, then
they can't get it anywhere else. They can get it there.
Senator Olson, counsel tells me that this is a state's high-risk plan, and if you can't get insurance any other place, you have to go here. So since it's high-risk plan, it's probably high buck too. But members, we're talking about, there's not that many vehicles of these type out there. They don't have VIN numbers, so we can't put plates on them. I think in the future, as these trucks become, more common, that we're going to have to figure out a way to get a VIN number on them.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out, too, that, I've kind of talked from an agricultural standpoint, but I have one manufacturer in my district that has one, and they have two different lots for storing their product, and they use it in town to move stuff from lot to lot illegally. They get that, and the police kind of look the other way. Winona County contacted me today. They are interested in buying two of them to do some of their county work because of the good gas mileage and the ability to carry a few items in that bed, and they were hoping that this would also, they weren't able to come up tonight, but they were interested in seeing how this bill progressed.
Yes, I was contacted.
Good.
I have a portion of Winona County. Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to help with Senator Olsen's question. I think it's probably been answered, but if you schedule your ATV or your UHV on your farm policy, then you get insurance that way, and so it's doable.
There you go. On the Skoy motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Go back to 933 if you want.
We're going to vote on Senator Bonoff's bill, Senate File 933. We got a clarification. It's just fine the way it is, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff moves that Senate File 933 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Dibble, we've got two other bills on the agenda that are going to take a little bit. Would it be okay if we went ahead, because some of these people are not from, well, not on the Higgins bill, but on the Pappas bill, I believe there's a few people from out of town. Is it okay? Senator Pappas, let's have your bill next, and then we'll do Senator Higgins' bill. Sorry, Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. As you know, this legislation would prohibit smoking in motor vehicles when children are present. And I want to share with you the compromises and the changes that we made in the Judiciary Committee that we think make the bill more reasonable and more consistent with my intent, which really is to educate parents. I'm not trying to catch parents or punish parents. I just really want to educate them about the high level of toxicity and the danger to their children if they smoke while they're in the car.
Senator Pappas, this isn't just about parents. This is if my grandson was riding in the car
right.
with somebody from school.
That's right. You're right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
It's adults. Right. And I'll just tell you what the changes are from the original bill, and then we do have a video we'd like to show you and a couple witnesses. First of all, on page 1, line 14, on the second engrossment, we lowered the age from 18 to 16, so under 16. So the child has to be under 16 before the prohibition goes into effect. On line 115, you see that it's a petty misdemeanor with on line 118, a $25 fine. So we're really limiting it. On 119, you see that it cannot be recorded on your driver's record. And on line 121 and 22, that means it's a secondary offense. So you cannot be stopped for smoking with children in the car, only if there was another moving violation, if you ran a red light or a stop sign or something. The fine is going into the tobacco education account.
I don't think we have anyone.
And there is a surcharge in these cases. That's on line 213, and that also will be going into the tobacco education account. So that's my attempt. Unfortunately, I wish everybody did what is the right thing to do without government telling them to do it. But there are a lot of people who say, well, and I ran into this with seatbelts. I had close friends of mine who would say, oh, that seatbelt's so uncomfortable. You know, they just don't make them for women's bodies, and I hate wearing it. But when they make it a law, then I'll wear it. And I think that could be the case here as well, is people may know maybe they shouldn't be doing this, but the law will kind of nudge them one step further into not really creating that toxic atmosphere for their kids. So let's start with the video. You're going to do it,
John? Is it for a child to be in a car with a person who is smoking? The answer. More dangerous than you might think. Even one cigarette being smoked in a car can produce dangerously high levels of secondhand smoke. The health concern is caused by what you can't see or even smell.
We're talking about exposure to what's called fine particulate matter. These are fine particles, very small, such that the eye cannot see, less than a thousandth of an inch in diameter. The reason why those are particularly harmful is because of their very small size, they can reach down into the very, very small recesses of the lungs and cause damage.
Using a car equipped with specialized monitors, Scientists like Dr. Klepeis from Stanford University conduct demonstrations that are able to measure in real time the dangerously high levels of fine particulate matter inside a car as a person is smoking. The United States Environmental Protection Agency established the Air Quality Index to provide the public with daily warnings about potentially dangerous air quality levels. This index is also useful in examining the particulate air quality levels in a car with a smoker. The index starts at green, which indicates good air quality that poses little or no health risks, moves up to red, which means the air is unhealthy and everyone may begin to experience health effects, and goes all the way up to maroon, which indicates hazardous air quality with emergency conditions that will likely affect everyone. The first demonstration shows what happens when a cigarette is smoked in a stationary car with the driver's window either open or closed. Within seconds of a smoker lighting up inside a car, monitors in the front and back seat measure dramatic increases in the levels of particulate matter from secondhand smoke inside the car. Within 10 or 20 seconds, the particle levels surpass the hazardous level on the US EPA index. When the color changes from maroon to gray, particle levels exceed the highest level that the EPA included in its air quality index chart.
A smoker would only have to smoke for a few minutes, only half a cigarette, and before the pollutant levels in the car, in both the front and the back seat, would reach 10 times the hazardous limit that EPA uses to judge the severity of outdoor pollution.
Even after the cigarette is put out, the toxic levels of secondhand smoke remain beyond the EPA's hazardous level for several minutes. Scientific tests show that the air quality in a car while someone is smoking is dangerous whether the windows are open or closed. Surprisingly, the pollution levels caused by smoking in a car can far exceed the pollution coming from the cars around you.
Here we have the side pack particle monitor that's measuring the air in the front seat of this car as we're driving down Sunset Boulevard. The levels are very clean. We really don't see any pollution at all, even though there's cars all around us driving around and we have the windows open. So our smoker has just lit a cigarette. We have all the windows partially or completely open. And as you can see, the levels are actually starting to increase just from the cigarette. From the background green clean level now to yellow or red level, which is getting up towards the unhealthy or very unhealthy level on the EPA index. So this is just from a single cigarette being smoked just for a few seconds in the front seat. Now we're actually above getting up towards the hazardous level, which is above 250 micrograms. So as the smoke swirls around the front seat, anybody sitting in the front seat or the back seat will still be exposed to an elevated level of pollution that would be considered unhealthy by the EPA.
Driving with all the windows closed, except for the driver's window open approximately 6 inches, the results are similar.
Now it's going off this scale, which is at 1,000 micrograms. And that is over the EPA limit for hazardous, which is only 250 micrograms.
Secondhand smoke will also pool in the back seat, often exposing children to high concentrations of dangerous particles that linger in the air.
Certainly, as a pediatrician, I'm particularly sensitive to the unique vulnerability of children to secondhand smoke. Certainly, pound for pound, they breathe more air in on a minute-by-minute basis, so that in any given environment, children are actually sucking in more air pollution than adults in the same environment. And secondly, of course, they are still in a developing phase. When they are exposed to toxins like fine particulate matter that's in cigarette smoke, it is damaging to their lungs, and those damages can last throughout their lifetime.
The scientific evidence is clear. Smoking in cars poses serious health risks. Even one cigarette smoked inside a car is shown to produce dangerously high levels of pollution that is unhealthy to breathe, regardless of whether the car is parked or moving through traffic, windows open or windows closed. Children, who are often just along for the ride, are especially vulnerable. To protect children from this danger, California passed the Smoke-Free Cars with Minors Law, prohibiting smoking a cigarette, pipe, or cigar in a moving or parked vehicle while minors 17 and under are present. To learn more, please visit tobaccofreeca.com.
All right, Senator Pappas, why don't you introduce your testifiers, and I just want to say thanks to the young man on the corner there for is savvy.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Ed Ellinger from the Boynton Health Center at the University of Minnesota is next.
Doctor, welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger. I am the director of the Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota. I'm a pediatrician and president of the West Metro Medical Society, an organization representing over 4,000 physicians in the West Metro area. And recognizing that tobacco use is our number one public health problem, and seeing the devastating physical and economic effects of tobacco use and secondhand smoke, physicians have been actively pursuing ways to reduce tobacco use and eliminate exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke. For years, physicians have helped their patients quit smoking. However, they recognize that a broader community effort is needed to keep people from initiating smoking. That's why physicians have long supported statewide tobacco use prevention efforts. And as data mount on the toxic effects of exposure to secondhand smoke, physicians have also been increasingly recognizing the public health importance of the state's Clean Indoor Air Act and the Freedom to Breathe Act. They have supported these efforts because they help protect the right of everyone to be able to breathe clean and safe air, particularly those, like workers in bars and restaurants, who have no choice about the quality of the air that they breathe. The bill before you today supports that same philosophy, that everyone has the right to breathe clean air, particularly those who can't choose the quality of the air that they breathe. And what more captive and vulnerable population is there than children in automobiles? Because of their higher metabolic rate and where they sit in the car, children are the group most negatively affected by secondhand smoke in cars. And as you've heard on the video, the toxic chemicals from secondhand smoke in cars rise rapidly to dangerous levels and remain at those high levels even after smoking has ceased, and whether or not the windows are open or closed. So passing this bill would help eliminate a significant toxic chemical exposure for an extremely vulnerable population. But this bill would do a lot more than that. As a pediatrician and the director of a student health service, I see the influence that public policies have on the establishment of social norms that impact the cognitive, behavioral, and ethical development of children and young adults. Policies have a direct effect on individuals, but they also set the norm of behaviors in our society that help educate children and young adults about what is appropriate behavior. This bill would help establish and solidify the norm that exposure to secondhand smoke is a significant public health risk. It would help teach children and young adults that they have some responsibility to help protect the people, the health of their neighbors. And it would help model the fact that people's actions have an impact on the broader society. This bill would also have an impact on the level of smoking in our society. Most smokers want to quit, adding another reinforcing message that tobacco use not only affects them personally, but those around them will be another incentive to help smokers move closer to their goal of quitting. As a pediatrician and a grandfather, I encourage you to pass this piece of legislation. It is good public health policy that will affect the health of vulnerable children and help improve the overall health of our state now and far into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Next we have Latricia.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, committee. My name is Latricia Vita, and I work in North Minneapolis at North Point Health and Wellness Center, and I coordinate an initiative to educate African-American women on the dangers of secondhand smoke and try to encourage them to not smoke in the home and in the car around their children. In 2007, we had four focus groups with women who were educated around secondhand smoke. We had school-age girls, women with small children and who had new babies in the home, women who belonged to faith-based organization, and African-American women leaders. And what we found in these focus groups, in all four groups, we found that everyone had difficulty with negotiation skills around having people not smoke in the car. So with the girls, they couldn't tell their parents, "Don't smoke around me." And then with the women, it was more of like my boyfriend or my husband smokes, and if I tell him not to, then he'll go. So I'll be manless, but, you know, we'll have smoke in the car. And so this bill could be the ultimate empowerment for these women. You know, I mean, you say, hey, it's the law. You can't smoke. So you keep your man plus. There's no smoking. Or, you know. know, your parent, you can, you know, you can say, I wasn't raised in a household where I could say to my parent, don't do something. So for these children, you know, in a car, it's the law. And we all know that Minnesotans are law abiding. So if it's the law, it's more likely that parents won't smoke around the children. And I just encourage that we empower these women and move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vita.
My name is Jeannie Weigem. I'm a volunteer with the Association for Nonsmokers Minnesota. Many of you voted in favor of the Freedom to Breathe Act 2 years ago. And what you may not fully realize or may not remember is when you voted for Freedom to Breathe, you voted to protect adult workers in motor vehicles. That law included, and I provided a copy of some an information sheet from the Department of Health, that explains that when a private motor vehicle is being used for work purposes, if more than one person is present in the car, that vehicle must be smoke-free. So all we're asking today is that you provide to kids in child seats the same protection you elected to give adult workers 2 years ago. As this is the Transportation Committee, I suspect it is worth mentioning that smoking is considered a leading factor in distracted driving. Those of us who have children recognize that when there are children present in the car, there are other distractions. And adding to that the distraction of smoking is actually a significant issue. Inattentive driving is a factor in roughly 10% of all fatal crashes, and nearly 60% of crashes nationwide are attributed to inattentive driving. And cigarette smoking is part of that. You think about the ash that blows off the cigarette and lands in your lap. You think about lighting the cigarette, putting it out, all of the rituals that go with smoking that don't fit real well with driving. And add that to children in the back seat. In my conversations with legislators in the last few weeks, I've heard a couple of ideas. One is that getting into somebody's private vehicle is really a pretty bad idea. We should not be doing that. But our expectations as a society for privacy in motor vehicles is really quite different from our expectation for privacy in our homes. Let your mind wander for a few moments. First of all, we have regulated many things in motor vehicles that we do not regulate in private homes. Further, research, the other thing is we've said that we should just educate people. If we merely educate adults, they'll take care of the kids. Research in several communities in both the metropolitan area and outstate show that the majority of adults do not smoke in their vehicle when children are present, and they don't approve of other people doing it either. But the Minnesota Student Survey found that 300,000 children acknowledge that they are regularly exposed, at least weekly exposed, to secondhand smoke in motor vehicles. That was from a survey in 2008. So this is contemporaneous. We know that weekly 300,000 children are being exposed to toxic levels of smoke in motor vehicles. Several Minnesota communities have gone down the road of education. They have gone through the process of winning important grants to try to educate people not to smoke in the car when the kids are present. And some of these programs have been very well funded and very well thought through. And I'm sad to inform you that we have learned that we've already got the low-hanging fruit. The people who are going to be impacted by education on this issue appear to have already bought the message. That's the over 70% of people who already prohibit smoking in their motor vehicle. So what this bill is about is the people for whom education has not been effective. The educational programs that have been used in recent years are innovative. They've been supported by the Environmental Protection Agency with some very high-quality materials. They've used new media and a variety of paid and earned media. And at the end of the day, we have learned that Minnesotans aren't very different from people in other parts of this country. there aren't any low-hanging fruit left that respond to education. The only way we move the bar at this point is as we begin to regulate this activity. And finally, not everyone is impacted by education. Everyone is impacted by secondhand smoke.
Thank you, Mrs. Wagaman.
Mr. Chairman, and then Joe is going to finish up.
Joe, how about your name for the record?
My name is Joe Klabeck. I'm 12 years old, and I have asthma. I have had to make a lot of sacrifices in order to keep my asthma under control. When I was younger, I had to take a lot of medicine. I wasn't allowed to go out for recess when the air was bad. I couldn't go to birthday parties at homes, bowling alleys, or restaurants where smoking was allowed. Because of my sacrifices, I was able to stop taking medicine. A few years ago, my dad got remarried to someone who smokes. She doesn't smoke in the house, but she does smoke in the car. I really like seeing my dad, but I am tired of getting sick from breathing in stinky cigarettes. I have talked to my dad and his new wife about how secondhand smoke makes me sick, but they never believe me. I get terrible headaches, and sometimes breathing is really hard. After a weekend with my dad, I sometimes have a hard time at school because my head hurts and I don't feel good. I took a petition to my school and asked a lot of my friends if they supported smoke-free cars for kids, and 36 of my friends signed the petition. Adults should now have the right to do whatever they want around us kids. This law would help me and all other kids whose parents do not believe that their smoking hurts us. So please vote yes on smoke-free cars for kids.
Thanks, Joe. Joe, you might want to ask your dad to watch Channel 5 tonight because I think you'll probably be on TV. Maybe that'll help your personal situation. At least I hope so. My grandson has asthma too, and there's no smoking at all around him. And I think that his mom and dad did a pretty good job at laying down the law. So I understand where you're at. So, any questions from the committee? Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, I thank you for bringing forward the legislation. I have a technical question on the page one when it talks about the petty misdemeanor. I'm wondering if when a person goes and applies for a job, I know that right now employers are so strict about doing their background checks and their various things to find out about the potential employees. And they have the questionnaires, have you ever been convicted of this, or this? Do you know if petty misdemeanor is on that list?
I don't believe so. Petty misdemeanor, it's like a ticket. So those involve felonies. We've been charged or convicted.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Pappas, they actually often, they do have the misdemeanor now on there too. And so what I didn't know is, it used to be just felony, but I am familiar that now a lot of them do have misdemeanor, but I didn't know if they had, I would hope they wouldn't have.
Petty misdemeanor is like a speeding ticket.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, this in California, this program, is that up and running for a while now? Do you know
when they passed that? Ms. Wagon.
Mr. Chair, yes, it's been over a year.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and I was wondering if, do you know, if you have results on the program of this first year? Do we know, like, has there been a reduction in smoking in these cars, or do we know that the type of people are being pulled over? Are they generally teenagers with other teenagers in the car, or are they actually parents with young children in them? Can you give me some clues on that?
Mr. Chair, it is also, I believe, a secondary offense in California, so they're not pulling anybody over, as would be the case here. Nobody's getting pulled over for smoking. It would be an additional offense. And I don't have numbers. If you'd like, I can get those numbers. I did talk with the Department of Health there yesterday, and they're quite enthusiastic about other states using their materials and would be very happy to provide us with additional information if you'd like it.
Thank you.
Ms. Wagman, how many other states have a program like this?
There are four other states. The first passing it was Arkansas, Louisiana, California, and Maine. The state of North Dakota Senate has approved the bill, and it is now in their committee process in the House. and South Carolina last week, as well as Utah transportation committees both passed these bills. We don't get to lead, I'm sorry.
It's disturbing to be behind Arkansas and Louisiana. Senator Day.
It's not, I don't mind it. Never bought a cigarette in my life. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I have four kids. They're all college graduates. They're all doing relatively well. I used to go, I just smoke cigars, a few cigars. I don't like people being in my life as much as a lot of people in Minnesota Senate are. And I don't care what it is. I knew when we had the right to breathe that it was going to come to cars. I knew it's going to go to fish houses. I know it's going to go to tents, and it's going to go to people's homes. That is the way we do things in Minnesota. I've been here 18 years. I've watched this. It's like, go pick on fat people. You know, they cause lots of things. Lots of things. Cost us buku bucks. So that'll be next. So somebody sitting out there is going to look and they're going to say, okay, but your time will come. Because, you know, how many people, people sitting in Minnesota can't even go out, even though they're pretty depressed right now. And they can't even go probably out in their backyard and have a cigarette because the neighbors are going to worry that there's a park next door and some kid might be running by. It happened to me. I went to a ball game in Minnetonka and my daughter and her husband said, you know, you better go someplace else. I said, I'm going to go over there about a block away. There ain't nobody there. I'm going to lean on that tree over here and get, can I smoke my cigar? She said, Dad, you better not. You better not. So I didn't do it. Same happened to me. I went to a hockey game, and I was going to decide. So I do, as you're well seeing here, I do smoke a few cigars. Fortunately, when my kids, two kids and myself, go to a NASCAR race, and we smoke a cigar, people don't care. That's why I go to NASCAR races. I like it. They have a beer, they have a cigar, and they enjoy themselves. And they are probably going to die with a lot of other things. If it's illegal, it should be illegal. If helmets aren't good, put on helmets. If people don't like all these different things that we have, we're slowly, just eroding, slowly but surely. If somebody smokes in a car with their kids in the back seat, they're an idiot. I will give you that. They're an idiot. They're just flat out just dumb. But you know what? That's part of growing up. That's just part of growing up. I don't even like it when I see every little kid that has to have a helmet on because he's out playing in the sand lot. I grew up when everybody went out and played. We played all the things that are totally bad for today's world. We played cowboys and Indians with spears, for God's sake, and swords and little guns. And you know what? Today's world is worse than it was back then. We didn't have all nobody cares about life anymore. But anyway, I just can't keep buying into all these. I talk to a lot of people that the breathing law and the Freedom Act that you put in lost their jobs. I know people that have lost their businesses because of that. So there's a lot of things that are on the downside of things also. And I have no fear. You're living in a state where this is just rampant. I mean, I got people here that want to take my car away from me, for God's sake, and drive less miles every year. So I'll have to go to Iowa and drive it around down there and do something. But it's just, there isn't many that think like I do. But you know what? I'm going to hang on thinking that way until the day I leave the Minnesota State Senate. And I'm telling people, I am sick of people coming here and bringing children along and try and make me feel like a terrible guy because I have a cigar once in a while, and I don't feel that way. I feel that the guy that has that and does that, he pays his taxes and he does what he wants, and we're going to be living in a state that I just probably won't like all that well.
Mr. Chairman, so obviously Senator Day feels very strong about this, and I'm going to let Ms. Wagum respond, but Senator Day, I just wanted to promise you one thing, is that I may be going to Cuba this year, and I will bring you back some Cuban cigars, and you and my husband can smoke a cigar together.
That's good.
Senator Pappas,
not in the car with the kids.
Senator Pappas, I really hope you don't do that.
Go to Cuba or bring him a cigar?
Bring him cigars from Cuba.
He doesn't deserve it. I'll bring him to you.
Don't bring him to me either, because, no.
It's legal. It's legal.
It's legal now?
Yeah, it's legal. I'd bring them.
Where did I miss that memo?
No, really? No, you can go. If you're on a legal trip to Cuba, you can bring back $100 worth of cigars.
Oh.
Well
then. Ms. Wagner.
Sorry, that's my little plug.
I want to get on that list, too.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I just wanted to let the committee know that Senator Day and I have had this conversation before when I was a redhead.
When you were a redhead?
When I was a redhead, and his hair was different, too. We've been having the same discussion, and we still love each other.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, she was even nice enough to write letters into my district.
Oh.
So I did have people calling me and say, keep protecting my freedom, Dick.
Well, I tell you, a lot of us tend to not agree all the time with Senator Day, but it's always on a very pleasant note. So
it's always 19 to 1, so.
Well, you've converted a few people, Senator Day. Every now and again, you get 18 to 2.
Yeah.
So, Senator Carlson and Senator Jungbauer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do want to congratulate Senator Day for surviving childhood. But, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, of the other states, one thing that does concern me, and other people have talked about it also, is having this in traffic laws. This is a health problem, and having a health problem in traffic laws. The other states that have this, do they have it as a traffic citation, or is it something else?
Ms. Wagon.
All of the other states that have done this, it's gone through the transportation process and has been part of traffic law, which is why we pursued that same direction.
Okay,
and the explanation for that is who does the enforcement, that it's not the health department that is dealing with the enforcement, which would be the case in Freedom to Breathe, but rather it's a traffic activity. It would not make sense for enforcement to be any place but there, which is why it has come to this committee and why it went through transportation in the other states also.
Thank you.
Yeah, we don't want to send the Red Cross out to write tickets. So, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, members, you know, I was thinking Arkansas, they probably don't have as many libertarians in Arkansas as they do in Minnesota, so that gets a little different. But, you know, I agree with Senator Day on this, and I take this very serious. I actually went to Chicago and took some epidemiology and toxicology classes to understand secondhand smoke, and I really think some of the what we get presented to us isn't exactly accurate as I'm looking at some of these deaths caused by secondhand smoke in Minnesota. And I've still asked doctors to show me a death certificate that says secondhand smoke, and nobody's ever come up with one. And that's not to say that secondhand smoke isn't bad, but I think we aren't telling the whole truth when we say people die to that, and yet we're not willing to sign the death certificate of that. And I agree with Senator Day. If people want to smoke, that's their deal. There's personal accountability. And if they want to do it around their kids, that's plain stupidity. So I'd rather see somebody, and I've thought that since I've been here, and I've only been here 7 years, but darn it, if we could figure out a way to outlaw stupidity, we could get rid of 80% of our statutes. So I just don't think you get the right outcome by banning things. And Senator Day is right. We're going to keep going down the road. And he used a great example. You know, here I bought this nice hybrid so I could save the environment and save gas and stuff, and then all these things come out saying, geez, I'm not paying my fair share of gas tax now because I'm getting better mileage and protecting things, so now they want to tax me for every mile I drive, and you come out with all these other things, and it is. It's just the way government goes about business. They take one piece at a time, and this brings us down that road. So for that aspect, figure out a way to outlaw the stupidity, and we'll go there. But I'm not in favor of this for seeing where it's heading down the road.
Thank you, Senator Jungbauer. Senator Pappas, there is one amendment that Ms. Berezovsky needs to put on this, and then I'm going to have Ms. Berezovsky talk with Pat McCormick, who's the director of Driver and Vehicle Services. We just got done passing an anti-masking law that Senator Dahl had, and that deals with commercial drivers. And when you have a secondary offense, that opens the door for the feds to come back in and say, you're still masking, and now we're going to fine you 5% of our public safety money. So we'll have an amendment, if this bill makes it to the floor, that it take care of that masking issue. It won't do any damage to your bill. It just will make sure that that we're not going to get in trouble with the feds. Okay? But Ms. Berezovsky okay. Line 1.24 and 3.27, delete account and insert fund. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Senator Pappas, that's just the correct name of the fund. Senator Dibble moves. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
All right. Senator Kielash moves that Senate File 359, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. That would be the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Senator Kielash moves that Senate File 359 with no recommendation be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Yep.
And thanks, Joel. Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins, Senate File 541.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we start out with the A3 amendment? I believe these are things that Ms. Berezovsky has identified that are technical that need to be fixed.
All right. We'll get the A3, you said?
Three.
The A3 amendment passed out. Thank you. Senator Higgins, why don't you explain the A3 amendment quickly while we're having it passed out?
I couldn't begin to. Maybe Ms. Berezovsky.
Oh, Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senators, the first change on 1.2 that refers to 2.31. Well, the way the bill is structured is that the Section 3 sets up a specific violation in state law, which is a penalty for the owner or lessee of a vehicle that's driven in violation of of red lights, basically. And then Section 4 authorizes the local authorities to implement that program. So this first change on 2.31 just refers back to the previous section that sets up the ground rules for the program to make sure there's nothing inconsistent between the local program and the state authorization. Then on page 3 after line 5, the next change requires that when a citation is issued, and it may be issued by mail, it has to include a copy of the images that were produced by the automated enforcement system. The next couple changes are just renumbering, and then 1.11, there's an effective date on page 4. It's just an immediate effective date for the creation of the special fund, and that conforms with the effective dates on the program itself, which is immediate. And the final change is just a technical change in the appropriation language to make sure that it's clear that the money in that clause 2 is for grants.
All right. On the A3 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Higgins, did you have any other amendments that you wanted to do right now?
That's the only one we'll do right now.
Okay, let's have the testimony then.
All
Senator
right.
Higgins, and just make sure that, we've heard the photocop bill several times, and we have several other bills to do. And,
all right, we'll just start with my testifiers then, since you already know the bill.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Higgins.
I have some introductory information. It's a little different from last year. But we'll get into that as we go forward. So my first testifier tonight is Michael Dold. He is an Anoka County deputy.
Good evening, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
My
Dold.
My name is Deputy Michael Dold. I'm currently a deputy assigned with the Anoka County Sheriff's Office. Last May 29th of this year, I was involved in a vehicle accident in which the lady ran a red light and struck my unmarked squad car. After the accident occurred, I spent approximately 10 to 12 days at Hennepin County Medical Center, and it's been months and months of rehabilitation ever since. I had 2 bleeds in my brain, which have resulted in numerous issues concerning cognitive abilities, not sleeping at night, and ongoing issues that were as a result, direct result of the accident. It was shown by the State Patrol and proven that she was possibly an inattentive driver as she had her 16-year-old son in the vehicle during the time. Regardless, she ran the red light and was not paying attention that day as I was returning from the patrol station to go to my place of business, which is at Oakview Middle School in Andover, Minnesota. I'm a school resource officer for approximately 4,000 children in the city of Andover. And that was one tough thing. To lose those children for pretty much the rest of my summer, not being able to see them the last few weeks of school because I was in a hospital.
Thank you, Mr. Dole.
Mr. Chair,
sorry about your crash.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen and then Senator Jungbauer.
I'm not ready for the end of this story. Was she charged, and what's your timeline for recovering, or will you recover?
The current status of the case is that it's been turned over to the city prosecutor in the city of Andover. That's still up to debate on what the city prosecutor is going to do with the case. And as far as my prognosis, I still have ongoing medical sessions with my 2 neurologists at Hennepin County Medical Center that are ongoing. My next one will be in May. And I've completed my therapy, my speech therapy, occupational therapy, and physical therapy just this last December. Dependent upon, I don't find any more circumstances that I'm lacking certain areas that I used to have, such as vocabulary being number one with that. As every cop knows in this job, articulating in your reports is basically your entire career.
And when you can no longer articulate a report or use the right vocabulary in it, that could be a career. Okay.
Thank you. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I want to try to choose my words well here, since it was friends of mine that were involved in that accident. But that's not what I guess I'd like to see a copy of the report, because a lot of other deputies and people out in the area are saying some things different that are supposedly in the report. So before we take that at face value, I'd like to see a copy of that report. If we're talking about it in public right now, what you're making in terms of public statements.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I do have copies of the report with myself, and I also have photos of the actual vehicle here that was involved in the accident, if you would like to see those.
Oh, I've seen plenty of the photos.
Mr. Dole, maybe you can see Senator Jungbauer when the bill is done and let him look at those reports, if you
yes,
would.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Great. Senator Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dodd, again, I'm sorry that that happened. I know we're here for the traffic light device automated enforcement, or photocop, and if that would have been in place, would that have stopped the accident?
I believe it possibly may have been a factor that may have stopped the accident. My experience in working in Anoka County in the 7 years that I did work the road before I left the road into my current position, I've kind of noticed a kind of a theory of, quote, while the cat's away, the mice will play. Driving a marked squad car in the county of Anoka County, you come to an intersection, it's very rarely you're going to find a violation. Every single day that I drive my unmarked squad to and from my school or carrying out my duties, I see numerous violations. And I believe it's to the fact that maybe people say, well, I don't see a police officer here, so I'm probably not going to get caught if I run this red light or if I do this illegal lane change or if I do this.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dodd, you mentioned one thing about having a squad car there and the effect that that has. I mean, do you feel that if a squad car was there that it would have more of an effect than a traffic device that no one may or may not know is there?
I think it would work as almost the same role as having a squad car there, knowing that there would be some type of penalty that they would be held responsible for their actions for running a red light, for instance. They would be held to the same penalty if a police officer was standing on that corner or a squad car was there.
Okay. Thank you.
And on page 3, the bill does specify there's got to be a sign. It has to say that this interchange or intersection is patrolled by photocop or whatever the sign might say. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, I wanted to make the committee aware and our testifiers as well and people know that I'm very into safety at intersections. I run Summit Avenue regularly and ride my bike up there, and I've been hit 4 times up there. The last time was by a squad car that didn't stop for a red light. So I don't know that, our peace officers get distracted just like anyone else. So distracted driving, and I have a distracted driving bill that we're trying to wade through because I'm very serious about these kind of issues. I don't know if this is the right way to handle it, but I just wanted to let you know that as we're moving forward on this kind of stuff, this is things that I'm very passionate about trying to be sure that we get a handle on the way people are driving. And I see it on a daily basis. I'm up in Anoka County, and there's so many intersections where, quite honestly, people just don't stop. They don't even care. They come out and just sitting at Highway 65 and Viking Boulevard up in my district the other day, people in a turn lane, 6 out of 10 drivers didn't even slow down for the red light. They turn. So it is an issue, but I want to make sure that we understand as these issues, and I want to protect lives and property damage, but let's think the whole thing through as we're looking at the photocop issue.
Only one testifier so far.
Thank you. Senator Higgins, your next testifier.
Mr. Chair, next is O.J. Doyle representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association.
Mr. Doyle.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. As some of you know, I was a 15-year paramedic. Our support for this legislation is that it prevents what are probably the worst or amongst the worst kind of accidents that you'll see, and those are the T-bone accidents. On both sides, the driver and passenger are very vulnerable. This is how you fracture pelvises, femur fractures, collapsed lungs. And we feel from what data we've seen that this legislation would have a preventative effect. The second reason that we support this is because a small portion of the fines would go towards supporting, maintaining the trauma system in Minnesota. It was enacted by the legislature in 2005, and as more and more hospitals participate, it's increasingly expensive to enhance the level of care available in rural Minnesota. And in the metro area, the level one trauma centers, it's very expensive to maintain them, and it seems like there's some symmetry to the injuries that are caused by this and maintaining the trauma system. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Any questions for Mr. Doyle? Senator Higgins.
Next, Mr. Chair, I have Barb Thoman from Transit for Livable Communities.
Ms. Thoman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Barb Thoman. I'm a staff person with Transit for Livable Communities. We strongly support this bill as advocates for non-motorized travel. This is a very important issue to us. People who walk and bicycle and people who walk to public transit are some of the most vulnerable users of the transportation system. They are people that don't have an airbag, that don't have the safety that you get when you're buckled into a motor vehicle. Red light running presents a really hostile and dangerous environment, not only for those who walk, but for those who are then discouraged from walking and biking. I'm a mother of a child who is a school crossing guard, and I'll tell you that most of the parents who don't let their kids walk to school say they don't because they're afraid of traffic safety. They're not afraid so much of strangers, but they're afraid of traffic safety. Also now I have a high school student who wants to bicycle to school, and she wants to cross Snelling Avenue, and I live in fear every day that she rides her bike across Snelling because I know of the study that the DOT did a number of years ago showing that one of the worst intersections for red light running was just north of I-94, about five blocks from where she wants to cross Snelling on her bicycle to ride to school. So riding a bicycle and walking are two of the most environmentally friendly modes of transportation. They're also very healthy modes of transportation, but when we have so many people breaking the law by running red lights, it discourages people from walking and biking. So we strongly encourage you to support this bill.
Thanks, Ms. Holman. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, next is Lieutenant Greg Reinhardt from the Minneapolis Police Department.
Lieutenant.
Mr. Chair and Senators, thank you. I don't think I need this.
Well, we have to get it on the tape, though,
you'll
Lieutenant.
Be able to.
So. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. I'm Lieutenant Greg Reinhardt from the Minneapolis Police Department. In 2004-2005, when this program was initiated, I was the head of the traffic unit, and I was tasked to change or affect driving behavior in Minneapolis. At that time, I was given the directive to go ahead with red light traffic enforcement. We did our research, both legal and also environmental and accident data. And we decided on a product or a way of presenting police services in a little bit different or more unique way than it has been delivered elsewhere in Minnesota. We decided on the Stop on Red program. Now, in the interest of time, I'll cut to the chase. It's not what we did and how we set it up. It's what are the results. Stop on Red program reduced traffic accidents at signalized intersections by 31% overall. Now, every intersection has four approaches, unless you're at seven corners, and I guess you have seven approaches. But every intersection has four approaches. Not every approach is instrumentated by a camera. But overall, it reduced the accidents by 31%, whether there was a camera there or not. Now, every intersection had a sign that was there. We had a web design that would allow you to have a flyby view of the intersection. You could look it up. You could see where the cameras were. But getting to the actual accident that is indicative of red light running, and that's a right angle accident, you can only have two cars in an intersection going opposite or directions. There's only one way to have two cars in the intersection at the same time. Somebody had to run a red light. Well, we reduced that by 42%. Overall, how the system was configured, it works. It reduces accidents. Now, I'm very good at writing tickets, and I can guarantee you that if I write you a coupon and I give it to you for a traffic violation, it's a pretty good chance you're not going to do that violation, at least in the near future. You're going to have a memory of that, and also you're going to have to go through the process of resolving that ticket. But when I reach out and touch you and give you that ticket, I'm only affecting one driver's behavior, and I'll change your driving behavior. Through the red light camera program, we were able to affect tens of thousands of drivers, not people who got tickets, people who didn't get tickets. They slowed down. They did exactly what we asked them to do, and that was to stop on red. Currently, I am a street commander. I manage deploying resources out on the street, and I have competing needs. I have to answer 911 calls. I have pre-planned events, and I have to respond to emergency services, including traffic accidents. I'm in favor of this type of enforcement because it helps me deploy people who can do effective work. I don't want to catch every violator. I don't want to punish every person who's gone through a red light. What I want to do is affect driving behavior. If I can't do it by engineering, if I can't do it by education, and I can't do it by traditional methods of enforcement, then I would like to have the option of doing it through an enhanced ability of an officer to enforce traffic law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Senator Olsen.
I understood you were going to have an amendment.
I do have an amendment, but I'm going to let Mr. Dahling testify first. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant, I have just a couple questions on your program. It was a one-year or two-year program that you're running it.
It was 9 months.
9 months. And you said how many tickets were actually issued during that 9 months?
We issued 25,000 tickets. Of course, there were more trigger events than that. Environmental reasons, cars that do not have plates and sometimes they're blocked. We weren't able to issue a ticket on every trigger event.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Lieutenant, the 31%, what is the actual number of accidents reduced? I've heard the 31%, but what is the actual number of?
I don't happen to have that number, sir.
Mr. Chair, and I believe that the, if I might add this, the last time I talked to the city of Minneapolis about this issue was like 30 accidents were reduced in that time period, and that's why I know this number gets used a lot. And the number of, the other thing was the number of intersections. How many intersections did you actually have the photocop at?
We have 801 intersections in Minneapolis that have a signal. We put it up at 12 intersections, but there were 16 approaches that were monitored.
Okay. And if I might, one last question, Mr. Chair. How did you determine those particular 12 intersections? How did you come to choose those 12?
Accident data. Okay. We looked at, if you get in an accident in Minneapolis, we write a very nice report. But at the end of the year, we compile that data. We look at the factors. And in many of those cases, we can determine whether it was inattentive driving or it was violation of a signal device. One of the things that you will find is there are intersections with many violations, but there's not many accidents. What we chose is we looked at a list of 100 intersections that had the most signalized intersections that had the most accidents. And then we looked at those to see if we could construct there. In some cases, we were going to tear up the road 6 months after there would be installation. We also then presented it to the engineering department of the city to see what that schedule was and also do a environmental study. Environmental study in that we went out used a camera to measure and see if there was actual violations at that intersection. There's no city in the nation that knows how many violations are at any approach or any intersection. The most sophisticated technology you have for that is a person standing out there with a clicker. Excuse me. We use some cameras to get more accurate estimate of the intersections, and then we took the top accident intersections and applied the solution to those corners.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, actually, if I had two other real quick questions. Lieutenant, in issuing the tickets, did you ever get data from those particular intersections? Were most of the people from the area, the immediate area, or if they from another part of the city that were going through that intersection?
Very good question. Over 60% of the people who received the tickets were from Minneapolis. I believe it was 39% that were outside of the city of Minneapolis.
Okay. And when the final question, Mr. Chair, is the ticketing process. How long is it before they actually would see something show up in the mail?
I believe the language of the law at the time is that we had to issue a citation within 14 days of occurrence. It depends on that enabling section. It could be 10 days, it could be 14 days, but I believe it was 14 days and then whatever regular mail delivery.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and Senator Dahl, under this bill, it's 21 days.
21? Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant.
I have a question.
Oh, Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Lieutenant, this is for Senator Higgins. In past years, we've talked about this, and we talked about the problems with it and the problem with ticketing the owner as opposed to the driver. And from what I understand, there are some technologies available where the cameras can, in some cases, identify the driver. And personally, I feel that this is a huge problem, and I think we need to do something. And I know that, for instance, Senator Dahl and I have sat through some legislative meetings in Burnsville where the Burnsville City absolutely wants this too. But is there a technology that we could trust to be able to get in to see through the window, or even intimidate enough so that some of the drivers could be identified, and you could identify them through their through the plate number and their driver's license, and tag identify the person and tag the person directly.
Lieutenant, you want to answer that one?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, we can. That was a choice that was made by local government not to do that, to cite the owner of the vehicle. There is technology that can take picture of the dog in the back seat if you want to give the dog a ticket. You can do whatever you want. You can take pictures. It's choices of how you want to set up state standards, whether you want to photograph the driver, whether you want to just photograph the vehicle and the license plate. Those are choices that you can make.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I knew that several people had interest in the photo of the driver, so I had the A2 amendment prepared if they were interested in looking at it. Require the photo of the driver. Maybe you can hand it out, and if somebody's interested in it, you're welcome to offer it. Mm-hmm.
Can we get the A2 amendment passed out? And since this is a transportation committee, we set transportation policy, and I'm one that says that if we're going to pass this and it's going to stay on the books and we're not going to get railroaded by the courts or whatever, that we need to have that image of the driver as well. So.
Well, people, Mr. Chair, are looking at that. Dana Banwer, who is one of the Minneapolis Assistant City Attorneys, is available to speak. And she, I believe you were part of the court case?
No.
No? Well, she knows about the court case.
Right.
Oh, Ms. Banwer, please.
Thank you. I'm Dana Banwer. I'm an assistant city attorney with the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, and attorneys in my office, actually the attorney who worked on the ordinance and worked very closely with Lieutenant Reinhardt and actually litigated this matter both at the district court level, or at the district court level, Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court, was here in previous years. Last year, she couldn't be here today. She's in Hawaii right now, and she wouldn't agree to come back to testify here tonight. Don't understand that. But I will talk a little bit about the case, because I know there have been a lot of questions and issues that have arose, and maybe some misinformation about that case and about what the court actually decided in that case. The case is State versus Kuhlman, K-U-H-L-M-A-N, and it involved a person who was cited for running a red light under the photo enforcement. He brought a motion to dismiss at the district court level. The district court granted the motion to dismiss and cited the reason as preemption, because there was a lack of uniformity between the city ordinance and the state law. So the reason for the court's ruling at the district court level was a preemption reason. It was not on a constitutional basis. And I might just add that neither the Court of Appeals nor the Supreme Court ruled on a constitutional basis. None of the courts got to a constitutional issue. They all ruled, and then the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court affirmed the court below and said that the city ordinance was preempted by state law. And the reason they rule that way is based on the uniformity provision in Minnesota traffic laws, 169.022. It makes our ordinance, as you're discussing now, made the owner of the vehicle responsible, not the driver. And because of that, our ordinance was not uniform with state law unless the legislation expressly provided that we could make the owner responsible, as you've done in a couple of other statutes, specifically with the failure to yield to emergency vehicle and the school bus arm statute. Those both specifically make or allow for the owner of a vehicle to be responsible. So again, the reason that the courts, all of the courts, struck our ordinance down was based on a preemption, a lack of uniformity with state law, not on constitutional, not on a constitutional basis. After that, of course, we stopped the program, and then there was a civil lawsuit brought by people who had paid their citations, and I believe that's still ongoing. I'm not completely up to date on that, or it's in the process of being settled, and money is being returned to the individuals. So, you know, if you have any other questions for me about that particular case, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, Ms. Banwer, I only have one. The people who, when you remit your check to pay for your fine, you're admitting guilt. So
correct.
The people pled guilty, and then they're going to get their money back?
That's correct.
I don't understand that at all, but so be it. So.
And Mr. Chair, just to be clear, this is not just allowing the city of Minneapolis to do the
photocopy.
Automated traffic enforcement devices. This would be a statewide thing that any jurisdiction could choose
to use
the
mic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Me, I wasn't loud enough. This bill would let any jurisdiction use the automated traffic system. It is not just a Minneapolis-specific bill.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if counsel can help, or maybe Assistant City Attorney Banwer knows. I'm wondering, does the failure to yield to an emergency vehicle law or the failure to yield to a school bus stop arm law allow for the driver, the owner of the vehicle, to argue that they weren't the driver? Is there a provision similar to this? I guess I'm wondering if that's the case, or it's not the case, if including this provision kind of defeats the test that the court has put before before the city in that case that you cited.
Ms. Bamber.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I don't have either one of those statutes before me. However, I do have the citations, and I don't remember off the top of my head. 169.20 is the emergency vehicle, and 169.444 is the school bus arm. So I apologize. I don't have that information.
Senator Dibble, we'll get an answer to
great, thank you
quickly. Ms. Berezovsky's looking it up. Further questions? Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, and then I have a question.
Senator Kielash has moved the A2 amendment. This is an amendment that says that you have to have the recorded image of the driver as well, and that kind of takes care of the whole issue, and that's kind of where I'm at as well. Senator Dibble, I don't like this putting tickets on cars. I want the individual responsible. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, could I just clear up one thing about the A2, because I want to make sure that you understand that it requires that a photograph be taken, but the citation still goes out to the owner, and then the owner would have to come in and show it. It allows the owner to use the photograph that was taken to show that that owner is not the driver, but the citation still would go out to the owner under A2. And as far as the question about, yes, the owner can be charged. Here under the school bus law, it specifically says the owner of the vehicle, or for a leased motor vehicle, the lessee of the vehicle is guilty of a petty misdemeanor, cannot be fined if someone else is fined. In other words, if they do identify the driver and charge the driver, and or if the vehicle was stolen, and it kind of mirrors the way it is in this bill.
So Mr. Chair, so there is an opportunity for the owner of a vehicle who is cited for failure to yield to an emergency vehicle or to a bus stop arm to contest that citation. So if it's a good idea there, it's a good idea here. Then I support the amendment. Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kielash.
Yes, I'd like to ask a clarifying question for Officer Reinhardt, and that is, after the photos are taken and before the citation goes out, I understand that police officers are reviewing those photos and deciding who gets them and not.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's correct. The police department did not do the processing of the photos. That was part of the vendor. We would set out what are our criteria. This is what a violation looks like. Does this batch of violations that you have reported, does that meet our criteria? Some would format that, but then would send it back to a Minneapolis police officer. Every violation then that meets the criteria of running through a red light was reviewed by a Minneapolis police officer. In this case, it was a traffic officer who essentially issued 25,000 tickets in 8.5 months, and if prorated, would have issued half of the tickets that the police department issues for moving violations. So it was very effective, but that officer could look. And in some cases, the officer would also use discretion. When I make a stop, and if I stop you on the street, I can counsel you or I can give you a ticket. And the officer also had the ability to, although not counsel in person, use some discretion. There are some cases because of pedestrians or emergency vehicles going through the intersection or other extenuating circumstances that it is not appropriate to issue a ticket. The officer used his discretion. More often than not, and there were plenty of violators, those tickets were issued.
Mr. Chair, Officer Reinhardt, this amendment requires a photograph. And I'm wondering if, with the review process that the police department has, would ticketing only those violators who also had a picture that matched the owner of the vehicle, would that limit you too much on the violations, or would that still be a good deterrent?
Lieutenant?
Mr. Chair and Senators, yes, it would reduce the pool of number of eligible violations. However, in many other states, such an event occurs. The pictures do not match up. It's a man driving the vehicle, but it is a woman who owns the vehicle. In those states, they still issue a citation in which the owner of the vehicle has an opportunity to nominate the person who was driving the vehicle. In some cases, you sold the vehicle. Tell us who sold the who you sold the car to, and you know what? We'll dismiss that ticket and write a new one for the new owner. And then we'll look and see if those pictures match up, and then we'll issue the ticket. So it's not an automatic that it goes to the owner. There's an opportunity to nominate other drivers. And we've had that. Fathers and mothers have nominated their children, and depending on their children's records, sometimes they've said, nope, it was me, because the insurance would be a little bit cheaper. But there's an opportunity to do that. It just reduces the total number of eligible violations to enforce.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, would it still have the deterrence that you is the main effort that you're looking for?
Well, again, it is the effort from the police department. It's not to punish every driver. It's to affect driving behavior. The way we do that is by, in Minnesota and throughout the United States, is by issuing citations, which have their penalty. Generally, reasonable, rational people will not continue a certain behavior, especially if they're fined a significant amount of money, or it affects their driving privileges in the future.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl and then Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant, a couple other follow-up questions, if I might. You mentioned the fines. How much are those, do you know, each fine?
Each fine is $142 in Minneapolis. That varies from county to county. Okay. The base of those fines are set by the state, mm-hmm. and then there's a limit to how much fines can be. By state law.
And Mr. Chair and Lieutenant, if I could ask on the systems themselves, there must be a capital cost for the initial setup and then maybe some operational costs. Do you know what those are?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair and Senator. Much like when you roof a house, you call in, if you don't do it yourself, you're going to call an independent contractor, and you're going to contract with them, and you can choose to do it a number of ways. In some other cities and some other locations, they choose to do it by violation. Now, I suggest that if you came over to my house and you were going to roof it, I'm not going to pay you per tile that you nail onto my roof. I'm going to pay you for a fixed cost, $3,000, $4,000, $10,000 to roof my house. And that's exactly what we did in Minneapolis. We negotiated a contract in Minneapolis. That contract was almost $1 million a year. But that is because of the number of violations that we had, the number of intersections that we had, and the amount of work that was required to process that. In other cities and other locations, it could be more because you have more cameras. It could be less because you have less traffic. So those things depend upon volume of the violations.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair. So is it your intention when you have the, let's say this amendment passed and now we've got the must include a photograph, is it your intention that the citation when it's sent out would be accompanied by the photo?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, in the A3 amendment that the committee adopted at the beginning of the discussion, starting on line 5 of that amendment, it said that the citation must include a copy of the applicable images recorded by the automated traffic law enforcement system.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, thank you for clarifying that. I apologize.
I don't think you were in the room when you
I don't think I was. So then I'm wondering with regard to when the photo doesn't match the driver, are you saying that the person who didn't match, they have to nominate somebody or they're on the hook? Or what if they just, they're not the person, therefore there's no money collected?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's one of the options that you can choose to do. that you can send out a nomination process, and if the person chooses to respond, they do.
No, it's not.
I'm certainly not the author of this bill, but if you wish to compel people to nominate, that's a choice that you can make too. Again, those are choices that there should be statewide criteria to set that. You can do either.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I'm not in favor of a process whereby we have people nominate other people, because I think that sets up a strange dynamic between drivers and other citizens. But I do support the bill, and I appreciate having the photo along with it. And I like the idea, even if we weren't going to use a nomination process, for the owner of the vehicle to know there's been the infraction. Even if there isn't a fee collected, I think that you will affect behavior by knowing that whoever drove that car, even if it wasn't the owner, they did that. And so, for example, if that's my child, I want to know that they've done that, and I wouldn't let them drive that car again, or, you know, there would be some consequence.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bonhoff, there is no, you can't, nobody's going to be mandated to roll on anybody under this bill, okay?
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I would inject this, that there is a defense that right. I am not the owner of the vehicle because I sold the vehicle. In that case, you would provide documentation that you sold the vehicle. It would give the local authorities the opportunity then to do a match-up of the pictures of the new owner and the picture that was taken of the vehicle in violation. So, but that's not compelled. I mean, you certainly can pay somebody else's ticket if you want to.
And Senator Bonhoff, the law enforcement still only has 21 days to do all of that background work, and that's a lot of work for a traffic violation. But you're right. If it's your vehicle and one of the kids is driving, it blows through the light, they don't tell anybody, and then you get the ticket in the mail, you're going to know right away, because there's your son's picture and there's a picture of the front of your car, and he's probably going to be in trouble. So on the A2 amendment, further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion does prevail. Senator Higgins, are your testifiers done? I think that Mr. Dalling had a specific issue that we want to deal with here in regards to a small chapter of law that's associated to this.
We're done, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Dalling, can we have you first and then Mr. Neumeister after that? Okay. Sure, that's fine.
Can I also have a handout for the
Yep, community? we'll get somebody to pass that out, Jim. Mr. Dalling.
Mr. Chairman, I presume for the Mr. Chairman and honorable members of the committee, my name is Jim Dalling, and I am the Minnesota Legislative Director for the St. Croix Valley Riders. And with me here, I will let him introduce himself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dwight Smith, President of the St. Croix Valley Riders, here to talk about motorcycles.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Dalling.
Mr. Chairman, I'll wait until they get the paper passed out.
Mm-hmm. Members, this has to deal with the issue that we took up here a couple years ago about motorcycles not being, they don't have enough mass to them to trip some of the signals. And so we allowed them, a process by which they can come to a stoplight, and if it doesn't change in a reasonable amount of time, they can kind of use their discretion to kind of a roll of the dice, right, Mr. Dalling?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would say there's more than a roll of the dice on that. But, Mr. Chairman, honorable members, my name is Jim Dalling, and I'm from Belchester, Minnesota. And I'm here today representing the St. Croix Valley Riders, a motorcycle organization of about 1,300 members, of which most are located in Minnesota. We're here today to voice our opposition to Senate File 541, the Photocop Bill, as this bill adversely affects law-abiding motorcyclists. Motorcycles generally do not activate magnetic or mass sensors at stoplights, which rely on such sensors to turn the light from red to green. This problem was alleviated several years ago with a law which allows motorcycles to proceed through through an intersection controlled by a traffic light if they have come to a stop, waited for a reasonable amount of time for the light to turn green, and then if the light has not changed and there's no one approaching the intersection or no object, vehicle, or person, a motorcyclist is then allowed to safely cross the intersection. Let me state unequivocally, we are not here asking for motorcycles to have the right to run red lights. We are concerned about the ability of motorcyclists to proceed safely and legally at intersections with red lights which won't turn green. This proposed automated system would take a picture of a motorcycle conducting a careful, safe, legal crossing and then send a ticket to the owner of the motorcycle. I'm sure there will be much more discussion about the merits of this bill. However, for the motorcyclist, the bill has the potential of creating a situation that negatively impacts motorcyclists' time and money to defend what is a legal maneuver under another state statute. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, did you have anything to add? Or?
Yes, I'm from Newport. And Newport's got a new highway. And right now, if you're traveling northbound, I live on the westbound of the highway, so I have to go through a stoplight. Not through a stoplight, but it never picks up the bike. And that's just one I stop at every day, at least three times a day, four times a day. And if this would go through, I see myself sitting at a light for 15, 20 minutes until a car pulls up behind me before the light cycles on to green. And at times, there is no cars. The way the law is now, we have a reasonable amount of time to wait and to make sure it's clear and proceed through. Mm-hmm. Normally, I like to wait two cycles of the lights because I can watch them go back and forth, make them, you know, different angles they'll be going through, and then I'll proceed through. But with this law, the way it states right now, I could be going to pay a lot of tickets or spend my day at one stoplight forever. So I definitely would like to see some change in this bill.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, as the latest legislator to join Abate, I was up at an event up at Fat Boys and talked to the guys up there, and they're pretty worried about what you're saying, too. But another thing they brought up was they brought up an example of the Patriot Guards. I think they were in St. Cloud. And a police officer, it was a licensed parade that they were in, and a police officer was holding traffic, and then he had an emergency call. And he directed them to continue on as they had, you know, they had somebody stopping people, you know, just one of the bikers was holding up traffic, and they were going through. So he had a concern. If something like that, when they're designated by a police officer to keep holding up traffic so the 200 bikers could go through, you know, if they're on Photocop, are they passing out 200 citations, you know, at each stop sign? So I said, well, I'll bring that up, and we'll see where that one goes.
Well, Senator Olsen, most of the time, and I think I don't see the lieutenant around here again, but when law enforcement tells you to keep moving, they're not going to write you a ticket. They want you to keep moving. So, Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is before us. And members, the A1 amendment just basically takes the motorcyclists out of this. It just says it prohibits the issuance of citations for violations committed by motorcycles. But it also makes a reference back to the actual law. You know, you still have to stop for a reasonable amount of time, not be an obstruction, blah, blah, and not get run over. Everybody understand the amendment?
Don't have it, though.
Oh, can we get the A1?
Well, it takes a long time to do this routine.
All right. Well, it didn't take very long to explain that, but we'll wait for the amendment to get passed out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of us are visual people.
I understand my blah, blah doesn't make much. visual impression.
Thanks.
But I may note that Mr. Dalling is a constituent of mine, and
Mr. Chairman,
I'm not going to go any further than that, otherwise we'll get in trouble.
May I have a copy of the amendment, too, please?
All right, on the Bonhoff motion to amend, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Mr. Smith, Mr. Dalling, and have a safe trip home.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members, also.
Thank you, all Mr. Right. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. For those people that may be new to the Senate, I've been a longtime fixture here at the particularly, I've been more partial to this body than the other one over the years. As someone who worked a lot with Jean Miriam, Randy Peterson, and a lot of folks have been here for a number of years on issues of privacy, freedom of information, and open government. I've opposed this bill since it basically came into the legislature by Senator Terwilliger. It's gotten better as it every year. It picks up a new author. But I'd like to share with you basically a number of things that I think that is in the province of this committee to, I think, work on as either report goes on or gets laid over or whatever. Basically, to say any citation based on red light camera that is not in compliance with the installation, maintenance, and operational requirements specified, because they do contracts with all these red flex type companies and the companies that do this, shall be dismissed, and all monies collected shall be refunded regardless of whatever the plea. There have been instances, what happens is people will find out there was some mechanical thing going on. If someone files a data practices request or finds out some things down the line, it's not that the city or the municipality is basically going to say, hey, we had a malfunction type machine and then wants to give all the money back. But there have been instances where that has happened in cities. So I'd like to suggest that language. Rather than the 21 days in the language that says that where you have to send it, sometimes memory gets faulty after a certain point of time. I haven't done any research on that yet, but I just recently saw 60 Minutes about when they talked about a serious situation of, you know, eyewitness viewing and things like that. But if someone asked you, you know, where, what happened 2 weeks ago or did your car or whatever, it's kind of hard to do that. So I'm going to suggest a standard of at least 10 or 14 days. This is what some other states and municipalities have done. Also, one of the things that some states and municipalities have done is that there's a difference between someone that just may go over that pedestrian line at 2 o'clock in the night or doing a very rolling type stop. Some entities have done, there's a difference. So they don't get a ticket on those kinds of things versus someone that blows through.
Mr. Neumeister, if you go past the stop bar, you're running the red light. That's just, there's no question about it. Even if you only have your front tires past it, that's a violation of law.
Mr. Chairman, your point, I'm just sharing with you a different perspective because we're using now technology in these kinds of things. The other issue is have a report on an annual basis. How many citations have been issued and how much money has been collected in locations. I have constantly said about the cash cow, and this will be a cash cow. In my judgment, depending on how things are done. Now, I'm not too clear whether or not the offense is civil in nature or not, and that's something that's in judiciary. One thing that you could do is put a cap of how many cameras a local authority may have based on the size. And again, some states have saying if you're of this 1 to 200,000, you should only have 15. In the contract that I read between Minneapolis and Redflex 2 years ago, it was at least 2 years ago, I think they had 15, and I may be wrong, but they had, in the contract it was maybe a lot more than that. I think 34 was the number. In other words, it just wasn't at that stable level. And one of the things I think is government may be more apt to increase to get more money. I also believe that there needs to be sort of like a sunset. I would suggest a 3-year sunset so that we can take a look. because technology is coming fast on this. This is not just this. Redflex, who I did a little bit of research on, is trying to monopolize, in my judgment, the states. They do a lot of stuff in Arizona. They get a lot of, you know. So I'm curious to know what comes first. Is Redflex monopolizing or safety? And that's just my point of view. I do think also that there should be all, like they have in Arizona, clear and conspicuous signage, rather than these little signs that you have now that you are entering in an area. And all locations in some states have entertained this, whether or not, I don't know if they've done this or not, all locations will have a 30-day grace period or some type of grace period so people know, you know, it's not put up one day and then all of a sudden, but so many days afterwards. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are some concerns I think that hit some of your province of area. There are some things that due process, constitutionality, and those kinds of things. Should it be the owner? Should it be the, you know, the person itself? That's another issue, and that will be in judiciary. One other point in the bill that I read, it said it cannot be used in insurance, or it didn't say it cannot be used in insurance, but it cannot be used, does not go on your driver's license. The point is it's still a public record on the local level. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is that, you know, the data investors or data gatherers, whatever you want to call it.
Mr. Neumeister, I'm going to have an amendment to fix that here in just a second because that's part of the masking. This is going to be reported to the state. A moving violation is a moving violation, and it's going to get reported to the state.
Okay. And, see, I'm more of that it should not be reported, but and I can understand. But my point is that if you're trying to do the same, you can still get it on the local level. So, you know, you got to do both. But it seems like you're going to take that out anyways. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my concerns. I'm sure that will be debated as time goes on. Thank you for the few moments of your time.
Thanks, Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Pardon? Mm-hmm. And he's actually one of the last of the true citizen lobbyists right here. So, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, he raised a point that had crossed my mind about this being a cash cow. I was reflecting on the fact that Minneapolis had used this in 12 intersections, was it? And it cost $1 million a year to maintain that, to install and maintain. How long does it take before the cash cow starts getting milked?
Well, Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, I don't have a calculator, but if you multiply 25,000 times 148, that must be like $30 million, isn't it?
Three and a half million.
Don't let me do math without a calculator.
That's why he's not on the finance committee.
Let's solve that budget.
We'll put him in charge of taxes. All right.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted somebody else to do the calculation so I didn't have to think about it.
Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think there's a lot of talk about the money, but I go back to the safety issue, and how can you put a dollar amount. And I kind of forgot about this incident until there was some discussion about this is all about, you know, collecting money. But when I was over nine months pregnant, I was driving out of Minneapolis on 6th Street in my car with my son. The light turned green. I went through the light, and a car ran the red light and hit me. I was in a Volvo, I will say that. But it was very scary in that it could have affected three lives. So when I think about this bill and I think about the fact that you're downtown, you're driving, I think this is all about safety, and that's, I guess, where I'm focused on with this bill. And if along the way there's some dollars that can go to trauma units, I think that that's a good thing. So I know that we try to focus on that in this committee. So, Senator Higgins, thank you for bringing this bill forward again. And also that it's also available to other communities. I know that in my community there are some who think this is a great idea and look forward to, not that we would implement it, but have suggested to me that we should consider these kinds of technology in today's world. So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and Senator Higgins, and I will say that I'm going to vote against the bill. And I've never really considered myself a libertarian, but on these kind of issues, I think we're headed down the wrong road, and having just come back at 2:30 this morning from New York City, and specifically Times Square, it was amazing to me that they park several officers on every intersection of Times Square during peak times of people being there. You know, I'm still going to want the personal touch. I don't know how we pay for that, but God darn it, I just don't think we put cameras everywhere, and I'm all about safety, but I just don't. I don't want the government watching every darn thing I do. And so that's where I'm at.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Chief Dolan from Minneapolis sent an email today saying that one more aspect of these cameras that we probably haven't thought much about is that sometimes there will be a an officer chasing another car, and sometimes you can get up to some pretty high speeds, and on occasion that gets to be a very dangerous situation. And he's of the mind that if they approach an intersection that has the camera system on it, the chase could stop at that point because the camera then would record the car, the license, and then the picture. And then that safety and the squad car could back off and maybe avoid one of those high-speed chase incidents that, you know, we've all read about with such sadness.
Are terribly disturbing. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Higgins, and I appreciate that. And I can tell you the parameters under which I would support the bill. I have an inattentive driving bill, and it's an after-the-fact bill where if you cause property damage or if you cause bodily injury, you get ticketed after the fact for that. If we were to use Photocop just for and some even serious ticketing of people that cause accidents, because I think if it's there, it'll change people's habits, mm-hmm. if we're not ticketing them for everything. But if we want to use it every time an accident's caused, property damage, bodily injury, the chases, I'm with you. I just don't like it as the ticket all to change the habit, because I think people will start watching what they're doing so they're not causing an accident just because the camera's there.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, that's true. The one of the cameras is located, I don't know, maybe six blocks from my house. And that's an intersection that I've never wanted to be like the first car into the box, you know, after the light changes, because people just blow right through it. And when we were using the cameras, there was a behavior change that was occurring. And that intersection didn't feel so scary after a while because people were seeing the yellow light and were thinking about actually stopping rather than going faster. And so I think there is a behavior aspect to these cameras as well, and probably even in the intersections where the cameras are not.
Members, we have a quick amendment here to take care of. On page 2, line 22, put a period after license on driver's license, delete and everything after, and then delete line 23. So there'll just be a period after license that takes care of the masking issue. On that amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, there were a couple of references made to signage regarding this. Did you do some warning signs that those intersections were?
The ones in Minneapolis now, Mr. Chair.
Oh,
Senator,
I'm sorry,
Olson?
I didn't see this.
Senator Olson, yep. The bill calls for signage, and in Minneapolis we did have signs when we had the system going before.
Mr. Chairman, is that just prior to that intersection, or is it just general signs so that they may think it could be at anyone?
They're as, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, they are as you approach the intersection. Yes.
Senator Dibble moves Senate File 1090 as amended. I'm sorry. 541 as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Higgins.
Senator
Dibble, you got two bills up now, and you've got the same two testifiers on each one. So Members, I appreciate your patience for being here so late. And
you can make restitution for it by some substantive way, like if you do it again, provide pizza or something.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
And yes, next time we have an evening meeting, the chair will provide food, not beverages, just food of my choice.
Chair, I've got
just a second
some
here.
Potato chips back there.
If we can get some of the other conversations in the alcove to go outside, we'd appreciate it. Senator Dibble, you have
potato chips and an orange back there. People can help themselves to it.
Okay. if anybody's hungry, there's potato chips and an orange.
I provided peppermint patties to keep everyone a little perked up through this presentation. Mr. Chair, members, I have Senate File 1089 and 1090. They are similar subjects, slightly different approach in each of the respective bills. They both have to do with the improvements that are made to short line railroad track, and they try to create some federal conformity with some tax. Federal tax laws that have been enacted and recently reenacted as of last year. Very quickly, I'm sure the committee is familiar, of course, with our short line, our class two and class three railroads. In many cases, those are railroad companies that have taken over rural track or spurs or short lines, as the description provides, from the larger class one railroads, many times in our rural communities, of course, and from small towns, get it to the class one rail lines, so that then those goods can get to the national markets. A lot of the track that was purchased was old, worn out, some up to 50 and 100 years old. And so the federal government recognized that these are important, vital rail lines. Some of these smaller companies that have stepped in where the class ones have abandoned or don't want to service those markets should receive a little bit of help in getting their tracks updated. So there, a tax credit was allowed under federal law for 50% of the cost of track improvements up to a maximum of $7,000 per mile. So that's $3,500 per mile. In the first bill I have, we would enact a similar tax credit program in Minnesota, and mirror that $3,500 per line of mile, allowing a net or a sum total of $7,000 per line, if you added the federal credit as well as the state credit. If you'd like, I can jump over to 1089 and talk about the alternative. We, of course, wouldn't pass both bills.
Sure.
1089, that would, of course, as you can imagine, that would be a significant amount of money from the state because it's a direct credit that they would take against their taxes, so it would be the actual dollar amount that we imply. But we've never allowed the Class 2 and Class 3 railroads to exclude that credit from their income when they prepare their state income taxes. So they have to add those dollars back in to their income for state tax liability. So this would simply allow for the federal tax credit, allow that amount that they receive to remain excluded from the income that they report for state tax purposes. Which removes somewhat of a disincentive. It's far less, of course, in terms of Minnesota tax that they're liable to pay, but at least it sends a signal, that we support the federal tax credit. The idea of the federal tax credit remove a disincentive for the Class 2s and Class 3s to take it. It's a little bit of a benefit. I think fiscal note is estimated. We haven't received an official fiscal note on 1090, but it's in the neighborhood of $175,000 at the top level of the for those corporations that are taxed at the 9-point-something%. With that, it's a very high level, quick overview of the proposal. We do have an oral amendment to 1090 if
Senator Dibble, what's your amendment on 1090, if we can take care of that real quick?
Rather than distribute the ability to take that exclusion over 7 years, I think that was just a drafting error. I think that was, we're thinking about that as a credit. We would just simply allow them to reflect that credit in the year in which the credit was taken. So take the exclusion. Mm-hmm. So
we'll have Ms. Spierzowski read the amendment then. Ms. Spierzowski.
Mr. Chair, the changes are in two different parts of the bill, and we are looking at Senate File 1090.
1090.
On line 4.13, page 4, line 13, we would delete each of the 7 years beginning, delete on the same line after, and insert that the, and same line, delete the word were and insert R, A-R-E. Then on 4.16, delete 1/7 of. And then, similar changes on page 7, on 7.12, delete each of the 7 years beginning, delete after and insert that the, delete were and insert are, and then on 7.14, delete 1/7 of.
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chair.
On the Dibble motion to amend, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Dibble. And members, what we're going to do is we're going to take both these bills and send them to the Tax Committee and let them figure out which one's best. We're just talking about what's good policy to help the railroads. And Mr. Rickel, you're here to speak on behalf of the railroads. I'm sorry.
I'm Ed Robinson.
Ed Robinson.
Dan's with us back here, but I've been intimately involved with the federal legislation. I'm sorry about the nose thing. I had surgery this morning, and it was Minnesota ice that got me, not Minnesota nice. But
did you fall, or did it fall on you?
I fell. Oh, no. I can't blame any drivers running stoplights or anything. But since the inception of the Twin Cities and Western Railroad, which runs right here out of St. Paul, to Western Minnesota and to South Dakota, we have more than doubled our car loadings. We built business in rural economies and so on. One of the things, though, that happened is we just ran out of track. We were lucky in this particular piece of railroad, and all the railroads in the state aren't so lucky, the small ones, our small business people in the railroad business, to have a fairly good plant when we bought it. It was the old Milwaukee Road main line across the state of Minnesota. But we've run out of capacity to handle the business volume. We've been so successful in building new businesses, entrepreneurs, small businesses all along our railroad, that we just didn't have the money. There's a shortage of capital funds all the time, and railroad track is expensive. Lay a new railroad track if the grading's all there, it's over $1 million a mile. Well, we were able, because of this federal legislation, to put in a new 7,700-foot passing siding that keeps our ethanol pieces of trains out of Minnetonka, St. Louis Park, and the western suburbs, which they didn't like this at all, and the police departments were particularly upset when we tell them there's 16 bombs in your town tonight. Can you keep an eye on them? But at any rate, we assemble them all in a rural area now and make a 100-car train that just rapidly passes through, going to St. Paul, the interchange. This is money provided effectively to us by the federal tax credit. We're doing another siding this year for new intermodal stuff for exports of farm products in containers, soybeans for tofu and stuff like that, going to Asia, which we built a terminal on. But these funds, from a federal standpoint, are critical. Now, what hurt us, and where I have a hard time selling capital projects to our board of directors with our scarce capital funds, is that Minnesota said, well, we'll take the federal taxable income. And if we took the credit now, the federal credit, you had to add back all your expenses to take that credit. So now our Minnesota, our federal taxable income went up. That's okay for federal purposes because we got the credit. But now Minnesota starts at that point on the tax return, much like you did for the ethanol producers here a couple years ago, who found the same problem. And Minnesota then says, no, you must also add back the credit you got to your income. So we've been in double jeopardy here with a big disincentive to a program that's building infrastructure in the state of Minnesota for a whole bunch of us small railroads. So we think this is really an issue of fairness. I can still get most of these projects by our board. The federal credit is significant. But just to not hit us for double jeopardy, just to give us back the amount of the federal credit that we would have gotten if we didn't take the federal credit anyway as expenses would be much appreciated. And this is what this change in the law does. It just takes away a disincentive to invest in infrastructure with private dollars in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Mr. Appetz.
Could I be very brief, Mr. Chairman? John Appetz with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. And let me reiterate just a couple quick things. The Congress enacted this program in 2005, and they reinstated it last year to run for a couple of years, and there's lobbying efforts ongoing in the Congress to try to get this implemented on a going forward basis. The rationale behind this was for the small railroads, the little guys, the class twos and threes, they needed to upgrade this old track because the large railroads are requiring heavier cars to move the ethanol, to move the grain, et cetera. And they couldn't move the heavier cars on the old worn-out track. So the whole theory here by the Congress was to make sure that the little connector railroads, if you will, the short lines, were able to move that stuff from the rural markets to the class ones, essentially to the world. And that's the whole theory behind this, to upgrade the track. Small railroads have had this problem for about 10 years since the large railroads have been requiring these cars, and this is a way to offset that particular sort of problem. The Congress finally came around with that. It's a small measure of help. If you were to pass and the tax committee were to adopt 1089, and that would be to provide a credit similar to mirroring the federal credit, it would be about $1.7 million. That'd be great if you could do that. We'd love to see that happen. Not a major amount of dollars in terms of the billions that we talk about in this day and age. But were you not able to do that, Mr. Robinson was pointing out the inequity, the unfairness in the tax code that we haven't conformed to today. And we'd at least like that to come to pass, understanding that that's about $175,000 if you cause it to happen. It's a small measure of support from the state. We really do appreciate this committee having heard us out a couple days ago and having adopted the chairman's bill with regard to the rail service improvement account. That was a great bill. We appreciate that. It didn't quite make her into the bonding bill last night. Would hope to see some opportunity for that again. This is a much smaller piece than that, and hopefully would encourage the short line and regional railroads to be able to improve their track going forward. So it's a modest effort, and we appreciate your help getting this bill moved forward. Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, you're going to see a couple of the members around here are on taxes, especially the big guy over there with the beard. So he's probably, yeah, your next-door neighbor there. You probably have to.
Keith?
He doesn't have a beard yet. Maybe Jung Bauer. Mr. Appetz, you're exactly correct. This is right along the lines of what we've been trying to do over the past 3 or 4 years to help the twos and threes out because it is pretty tough out there for them and they're the hub of the big cog. The rest of it doesn't work very well. So with that, Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1089 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1090 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.